And so this week we continue in that same place, picking up in the exact same spot where we left off last week. They are working their way again to Jerusalem and into that great moment. And so Mark 9, verses 30 through 37, let's read these together. It says, "Then they left that place and made their way through Galilee, but he did not want anyone to know, he being Jesus. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, 'The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after he is killed, he will rise 3 days later.' But they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, 'What were you arguing about on the way?' But they were silent, because on the way they had been arguing with one another about who was the greatest. Sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, 'If anyone wants to be first, he must be last and servant of all.' He took a child, had him stand among them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, 'Whoever welcomes one little child such as this into my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but him who sent me.'" Now, this is tough teaching from Jesus, as all of Jesus's teachings are tough. And sometimes we feel like, oh, well, there's some happy-go-lucky stuff that Jesus tells us about. You know, I want to be a peacemaker. I want to be, I want to be out in front of all these things with love and mercy, generosity. I can handle sort of that truth. But Jesus is telling us something about servanthood. Jesus is telling us about how to be great people. Jesus is telling us how to be and measure greatness. And this one we don't really want to hear, because he tells us that the first must become the last and be servant of all. And we don't want to hear that preached. We don't want to hear that taught in our lives. We don't want that Jesus to come and ruin the things that we already have, because that's not how I want to measure my greatness. That's not how I want to see and view my peers. That's not how I want to stand amongst all of them. But what we notice first is that Jesus really has this intentional teaching about suffering, that he wants us really to practice this vulnerability. And I've never taught vulnerability as a sort of discipleship moment, something to be practiced. We talk about practicing prayer, and we talk about practicing generosity, and we talk about practicing gratitude and the Sabbath. But I've never really talked about practicing vulnerability, making that one of our pillars of discipleship, that a true mark of a disciple is their vulnerability. But what Jesus is teaching here is something that's very intentional about suffering. Jesus' message about his coming suffering was very deliberate, and it was in this moment. This is the second of these revelations, that the Son of Man will be handed over to men. We've just come down off the mountain where it's, you are the Messiah, you are the one that we've come to know, and now you're telling us you're going to be handed over into the hands of men. But Jesus intentionally tells his disciples of his impending suffering and death, not as defeat, but as part of the divine mission, that I'm not going to suffer because we've lost the kingdom. And this is an important point here about suffering and about servanthood and about vulnerability, is that we don't fall back on these because we're weak, because we've lost. Jesus is saying in this moment, we've deliberately done this because this is the mission of the kingdom. That if you think that going to the cross was us losing the battle, then you've looked at it from the wrong perspective. But it shows that Jesus is willing to openly embrace vulnerability as part of his mission, as part of his acceptance, as part of his teaching to the people around him. That we openly embrace this vulnerability. We openly embrace this weakness. He didn't wait until his followers were ready. He spoke truth about what lay ahead. It's going to be a hard road. We are intentionally walking to Jerusalem to do these things. And it will be hard. It will be tough. And we will suffer. But suffering is part of the plan. He spoke about what was coming, and even when it was a challenge to hear, even when they didn't want to hear, even when it was confusing, even when it was unknown to them. And it's a great reminder that true greatness often involves embracing difficult truths. A true greatness involves embracing, holding on to things that we may not be able to comprehend, the challenges that come up. And we need to say that in order to be truly great, in order to be vulnerable, we need to open ourselves up into a position. I don't understand what's going to happen next. I don't have control over the situation. I don't know the way that the future is going to unfold. And that leaves me open to vulnerability. That opens me up to places that I don't know what comes next. And we're not altogether comfortable with that. But Jesus is telling us that true greatness lies in that. That if we cannot know the future, if we don't know how it's going to unfold, be a little vulnerable, be a little uncomfortable, live in that unfolding tension. And all of a sudden, Jesus is saying, yeah, there's something here. This is a better way to live. But Jesus models vulnerability as trust in God's plan. That we're not completely vulnerable, right? We're not just opening ourselves up to all kinds of attacks and all kinds of just weakness and things are going to go off the rails. We're opening ourselves up to what God's plan is, what His wisdom is for our lives. It's not what we hold valuable. It's not what we hold dear or true to all of these things that make us vulnerable. It's the fact that I'm open now to God's plan. I'm open now that I can take a back seat in some of this. I don't need to have complete control over everything that's happening. Because God's got this. But Jesus does model that vulnerability for us. He shows us that greatness isn't self-made, but rather it's rooted in God's purposes. That this greatness that we claim to want or have, or the disciples are really sort of gunning for, it's not self-made. We can't determine amongst ourselves who is the greatest. Because God's not measuring us by that. It's really rooted in a trust of God's purpose. John Stott said, greatness is measured in obedience. And so when we think of it from that perspective, and we understand that true greatness then is not defined by control, but by submission to the Father's will, that all of a sudden things are switching around for us. We start to see this from the perspective of Jesus. We can also say that true greatness isn't about self-preservation or avoidance of hardship. True greatness isn't about trying to weave your way and make life as easy as possible for you. True greatness is rather about humble dependency on God, even when the path involves suffering. Jesus willingly walked into suffering. I mean, think about this. I have a hard time going to the dentist. And that's when I can drive a car. I don't have to ride a horse or get on my bike or walk to the dentist. Jesus walked all the way to the cross, across deserts and across the landscape that was harsh to him, through countries and through regions that were not treating him favorably, the hostility that he had to go through, the ache. Jesus is willingly walking toward suffering. He's putting himself in a vulnerable position, saying, I'm going to walk through the desert as part of God's mission for us. He's really inviting us to follow his example. Is really walking toward this moment and saying, just as I have accepted suffering as part of God's mission, he's like, we are called to surrender our lives to the mission as well. Surrender not just our lives, but our plans and our comfort. Give them all over to God and say, you know what, God, use them for good. Make me a little bit uncomfortable. Make me a little bit vulnerable. But we don't like to pray that, do we? We don't like to go to that part because we want to say, God, expand my borders. Enrich my life. Give me your blessings. Make me feel important. Make me feel loved and seen. We don't like to pray, God, make me feel uncomfortable. Make me feel vulnerable. Lord, lead me down a path of suffering. Because as long as I know that you're in it, I want to be a part of it. If you're not in it, I don't want it. And so if the road is easy and it's casual and it's comfortable and it's not threatening to us, but Jesus isn't there, I don't want it. I don't want it. Because that's not the life that Jesus has called me to. That's not what greatness is in the kingdom. This may mean stepping into situations where we feel weak or uncertain, knowing that God's strength is at work. But maybe the most tragic verse in this whole thing, maybe even in the Gospels itself, is verse 32. They didn't know what he was talking about, but they didn't dare ask him. Isn't this a missed opportunity? Isn't this, these 12, I don't know how to describe morons. These 12 morons are standing here with Jesus, and he's talking about being led to death, being cast out into the hands of men. The Messiah must suffer. And they're just silent. They don't want to ask him a question. They don't want to open their mouths and say, what are you talking about? Teach us about this. Instead, they just look at him and their eyes are probably crossed and they've got drool coming out of their mouths because they're like, I don't know how to comprehend this, but I don't think I need to speak up. I don't want him to think I'm dumb because you ever do that in the classroom when you were in school? Well, I have a question, but I don't want people to think that I'm dumb, so I don't want to ask the question. But then probably everyone has the same question you do, and you're just brave enough to raise your hand and say, what does this mean? What are we doing here? What are you even talking about? And no one steps up. And I think like them, we often choose silence over engaging with difficult truths or instructions that really challenge us. I think that we see those things and we're like, well, I don't know what that means, but I'll never know. The mystery of God is too great to understand. Is it though? We just don't like what the mystery of God tells us to do sometimes. And so we say, well, I guess I'll never know what that meant. I'll never know what it means when Jesus is pulling on my heart to reach out to these people. I don't know what that meant. I guess we'll never know, right? The mysteries were too great for me. By the way, through all of history, there's only been one religion. There's only been one God figure who has wanted to know his people and who has wanted his people to know him. There's only one God that draws close as we draw close to him. There's only one God in the history of the world who says, you can know me. God isn't a mystery. We can open the book and read about him. We can live our lives and we can talk to people here and through our adventures and say we know God and he knows us. How do we today shy away from God's call to be vulnerable? We all share the disciples' tendency towards silence when confronted with confusing truths or situations. But we need to move beyond this passive silence toward curiosity and openness to growth. It's a great tragedy when we've lost our curiosity as a church and believers. When we no longer start to ask questions. You know how in the rabbinical history, And the Jewish tradition, the Bible, the Torah, was not the answer to the questions, but it was the beginning of the questions. And so as we read, as we worked our way through them, we would come to something and say, okay, well, this makes me start to question. What does this mean? And what does this mean? And what does this mean? And let's turn that diamond and see all the sides of it and figure out what this means. And now today we use the Bible as the answer book. How should I treat my neighbor? Let me go here to the book. And there's the final answer on it. Instead of saying, you know what? What does it mean that he's brought a child here? What does that mean for my life? What does that mean for my neighbors? What does that mean for the way that I'm generous to the people around me? And when we start with the Bible as the basis for our questions, we begin to be curious people. Remember last week we talked about doubt and doubt's place that it shares with faith. Right? When people start to doubt, they lose their curiosity and they don't give themselves permission to say, you know what, I need to answer these questions. They just say, you know what, I have doubt. I can't believe that's the end of the statement. But doubt leads us to grow our curiosity and say, what does that mean that I feel this way? What does it mean that my God didn't show up in this particular moment? We need to identify areas where we can learn to practice our vulnerability as a discipleship trait. Can we learn to become vulnerable people? Absolutely. Whether it's in our relationships or me personally in our ministry or personal struggles, how might surrendering control in any of these areas open us up to experience God's power? How do we respond to God's difficult callings? Are there areas like the disciples that we just remain silent and choose not to ask questions out of fear or confusion? How can we start embracing vulnerability as part of our faith? But Jesus says there is this paradox of true greatness, that if we want to be truly great, then we must become last. When Jesus overhears, he uncovers their argument about greatness, which is really at odds of the humility that he embodies. And their debate reveals this truly human tendency that we often seek to elevate ourselves rather than serving others. That our agenda is more important than someone else's agenda. Is that always wrong? I'm not sure. I'm not the one that's going to tell you that having ambitions or having goals is a bad thing to do. But at what cost? They're arguing about who is the greatest. And I think that this argument comes because Jesus took three up on the mountain. And the rest of them were stuck on the bottom. And James, John, and Peter go up there and they say, okay, well now, who's the greatest? We saw his messiahship, so it's definitely us. And I always get this question. We visit people who have known us for a long time and they know about the church and they say, how many people have you baptized? As if this is a mark that good work is happening in the kingdom. Our accomplishments are something to hang our hats on and say, yeah, oh yeah, the church must be thriving because we're just baptizing all these people. But again, how can we know? How can we know that this is the greatness that we're after? There's silence when Jesus questions them. You've been caught with your hand in the cookie jar, haven't you? And Sadie does this all the time. What are you doing? Nothing. What's behind your back? Nothing. So if I look behind your back, you're not going to have anything in your hands back there. Okay, I took fruit snacks. I thought so. You were up to something. And Jesus calls them out on it. What were you guys talking about back there? I don't know if we should tell him. I don't know. This is not going to be a good conversation. But he already knows, doesn't he? Because he knows the tendency of his disciples, of these 12 morons who are like, what have we accomplished here? Who is the greatest? How many followers do we have? How many likes can I get on Facebook? How many people are we bringing in at a weekend service? These are all marks of a great church, right? These are all marks of how we can build the kingdom. These are all marks of true discipleship and true greatness, according to what? No. Wait, Jesus is redefining greatness. He's saying it's not about likes and it's not about the things that you have accomplished, or it's not about the number of people you have in your seat. What have you done for me? How are you making yourself vulnerable and treating those who are vulnerable? Jesus flips the disciples' assumptions about power and status and uses this moment to redefine greatness in the kingdom. Because see, true greatness isn't about status or power or about titles or achievements, but rather humility and servanthood. Consider Jesus washing his disciples' feet. He didn't elevate himself and put his feet up on the table and say, "Someone come and wash my feet. I am your teacher. I am your prophet. I am your rabbi. I am your savior." The man that hung on the cross bent low and washed the dirt off the feet of those morons. He got himself in the dirt and he rubbed their feet that were filthy. And he said, "This is greatness here. Don't line yourselves up with who is following you. Line yourself up with what you've been doing for the people around you." In a world that glorifies fame, we have to remember that in God's kingdom, the last shall be first, and the servant leaders are the ones who are truly great. And now don't do this, though. "Oh, look how humble I am. Look at how many feet I washed today. How great am I," right? No. True greatness is, in God's eyes, marked by our willingness to be vulnerable and humble servants. And it really follows the examples of Christ in our daily interactions and service to each other. It's not about accomplishing something. It's about the heart. We really, as a modern culture, measure greatness, success, influence, material wealth. But even in the church, we prioritize the wrong things, the wrong metrics. Attendance, programs, social media popularity. How do these pursuits affect our service to those in need, though? How does our desire to grow and bring more people in affect our ability to serve those who are unreached? How often do we as a church get caught up in measuring greatness through numbers and programs or influence instead of measuring greatness in servanthood and humility and vulnerability? We need to let go of our arguments of greatness and seek ways that we can embody humility in everyday interactions. We could step back when we feel like we're getting competitive. We can offer support to others without expecting recognition or expectation. We can redefine personal ambitions to really align with God's value. And so this really gives us then the picture of humble service, that Jesus uses a child as an example of kingdom service. Jesus places a child in their midst, this symbol of vulnerability, of humility and dependence. And we kind of get this clean picture that a child is just a child and we just want them to exist in a vacuum. But children have food on their face and they have unwashed hair and they have dirty clothes and they have skinned knees. And Jesus says, "I'm going to grab this child and show you what it should look like." And we want to whitewash it in our heads and be like, "Oh, it's a beautiful young a child who's just so beautiful. And they've made the Christmas card. And that's the child we think in our brains." But those of us that have children know that's not what children look like. And Jesus picks up this street urchin, this gross, disgusting child, and says, "Look This is your illustration. This is who you should be like if you want to be a servant. Children had no status, and they were considered the least powerful in society at the time. And really, that didn't change until the Victorian era of our culture, where we started to take care of children more and more. And now we have been given children everything that we can to make them better than us. Children are completely dependent. They offer no advancement of status in society, and they could not repay anything for any services rendered. By choosing a child, Jesus shows us that true greatness is found in welcoming and serving those who bring nothing of value to us. And that's really the key, isn't it? That's really the key to understanding how we're supposed to serve. That we serve people who give us nothing in return, who give us no value. It's really easy to serve people who want to give back. It's really easy to serve people who can post it on their Instagram. I was going to go on a mission trip, but I couldn't find my camera. And that's the reality that we live in, is that if we can't serve people, but also serve ourselves at the same time, it's not worth it. And so Jesus is saying, here's who you want to serve. Here's who the vulnerable are. This is what it looks like to be a true servant. Serve this dirty child who can't give you anything, who has no value to you, who can't keep you recognized. Jesus' teaching invites us to embrace those who are marginalized, who are forgotten, who are weak. Jesus calls us to welcome those who are weak and overlooked, seeing this as a way to welcome God into our lives. Did you notice that? That serving the vulnerable is a way to welcome God into our lives. This act of welcoming symbolizes the true heart of servanthood, seeking and valuing everyone, especially those that are marginalized. True humility doesn't serve with ulterior motives, but reflects God's unconditional love for all people. It's through serving others without expectation that we model Christ's heart. And true service is not a task. It's an orientation of the heart. That's what we're talking about in these accomplishments. That I can serve and I can be generous and I can check things off on my boxes. But that's not true greatness. It's a reorientation of the heart. True service, as Jesus modeled, involves not just helping the important, but showing care for all. And through this, we reveal the inclusive love and humility of Christ. So I'm encouraging you this week, this month, identify those lives in your sphere of influence. Identify those people who are overlooked. Who are the children in your life? And I'm not even talking about your own children. I'm talking about people around you who are vulnerable, who are weak, who can, how about this, offer you nothing. Identify those people, one person in your life who offers you nothing, who offers you no value, and go and serve them. And that's a big and scary and bold thing to do, and it's an uncomfortable struggle. But Jesus is saying, you want to measure your greatness? You want to really see who's winning in life? Go and serve someone who doesn't give back to you. Go and serve someone who doesn't deserve it. How can we, in our daily actions, embody the love of Christ by welcoming and serving others? Reach out with kindness to them. Reach out with practical help. Reach out with a listening ear. Embody Christ's humility somehow to them. But we need to practice this vulnerability in our daily lives. We need to practice this ability to be weak and not strong? How are we measuring greatness? And are you a servant to all?